Welcome to Philadelphia Focus. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today, well, we're going to be talking about a wonderful collaboration between two fabulous museums here in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the Museum of the American Revolution, because going on right now, you can purchase a specially priced ticket. It's an adult ticket, $35. Buy it now through September 6th, and through September 22nd, it will get you admission to both of these fabulous institutions. And so that is what we are going to be talking about today. And my guests are Matthew Skick, he is the curator of exhibitions for the Museum of the American Revolution, and Kathleen Foster, the Robert L. McNeil Jr. Senior Curator of American Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And welcome. Thank you both for being on today.
It's my pleasure, Laura.
It's a pleasure to be here, Laura.
I've been looking forward to this conversation for quite some time. And let's get started. Kathleen, you go first, and then Matthew, tell us a little bit about the museum itself, and then we'll talk about why this particular collaboration.
I'm really happy to tell you about the museum opening its new spaces. We are just coming out of a very long construction period, and we have opened some gorgeous new public spaces designed by Frank Gehry, and then two new sets of galleries. I'm, of course, very partial to the American Art Galleries as part of this program, and they are showcasing the museum's collection of early American art, that is, from the middle of the 17th century to the middle of the 19th century. We're saying 1650 to 1850, more or less, but in the middle of that, we've got a great big gallery that's about the period of the American Revolution. So we wanted to partner with our sister museum downtown, the Museum of the American Revolution, in order to sort of tell multiple sides of the story of the American Revolution. And I think maybe Matthew can talk, too, about the ways that the American Revolution Center highlights history, while I think the museum is really telling the story of the arts in this period.
Yeah, we're really excited to bring visitors to both institutions here in Philadelphia. And we at the Museum of the American Revolution are really excited to welcome more and more visitors back this summer. We're in our era from the adoption of the Declaration of Independence in 1776 through the 8 years of the Revolutionary War, and then the first few decades of the United States existing as an independent nation. And we tell these stories through object displays, through immersive theaters, full-size figure tableaus, really trying to immerse visitors in the period of the Revolutionary Era. And so when visitors go see silver or furniture or paintings at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, they can also come to the Museum of the American Revolution and sort of see some of those objects sort of in action in our theaters, in our tableau scenes, and in our immersive displays. So we're really excited about this joint ticket.
I so love both museums. I have to say that you get to experience the actions of these people in this amazing time, but then you can go to the Philadelphia Museum of Art and see their ephemera. You can see their faces, but you can also see how they lived, the upper class. And we'll talk about the collection at the American Wing.
Well, you know, you've hit right on one of the themes that we share. One of the things that I love about this collaboration is that we have done a certain kind of conceptualization of the installation in order to bring in these larger themes about the revolution. The big gallery that I'm describing, we call it Loyalty and Independence, and it's about choice. And this is a theme that is also brought up at Matthews Museum, this idea of people taking sides during the revolution and how just average people would have responded to the political crisis, because at that moment, people didn't know what was going to happen next. And I would say historians have demonstrated that it was actually a rather small minority of Americans who were really rabid about the revolution. Most people were kind of in the middle and found it difficult to take sides. And so at the museum, we talk about this issue of loyalty and independence from the point of view of artists and people who made things. Because if you're a craftsperson, you're just trying to do business. You know, you just want to get on with your life. And actually, a revolution and turmoil is not something that you're inviting. So we really thought about looking at artists, somebody like Copley, great portrait artist. Copley painted people on both sides of the political spectrum. he was trying to walk a tightrope and make business, you know, among both the rabid radicals of the Sons of Liberty in Boston and also the people who were the loyalists. And Copley himself was a loyalist. So thinking about the dilemmas of people like that, trying to make a living during a period of choice, we organize the gallery in ways that helps you sort this out. We have one whole wall of paintings by artists who basically left colonies and went to London. They were the people who sided with King George, and it was for multiple reasons. I think many of them left not because of their politics, but because of their ambition, because London was the place where you made a reputation. So Copley, for example, water was getting a little hot in Boston when he left in 1773, but also London was the place where you made a name, where you could make big money, where you could make a reputation. And the same thing is true for Benjamin West. West is a Swarthmore boy, and we have an early painting by Benjamin West painted when he was just working in Bryn Mawr. And then he goes off to Europe in 1760, makes it very big in London. He becomes the royal painter to King George. He is the president of the Royal Academy. This is a provincial kid who is like at the top of the pile in England. So there's a story here of American artists sort of making it big on the world stage. And actually we have a lovely quotation from Benjamin Franklin when he was in Paris in 1783, when he says, "All our geniuses go to Europe." And you can see that he's kind of both in despair about this and terribly proud. He says, "The greatest history painter, West, the greatest portrait artist, Copley, and the greatest landscape painter, Taylor, are all in England right now." And in fact, Taylor is another Philadelphia painter. We've got a couple of his landscapes so you can see how good a painter he was. So we had American artists here returning to England and becoming big successes. Well, across the hall from this row of, shall we say, loyalists, we have Charles Wilson Peel. Peel went to London, studied with Benjamin West, who was kind of a father figure to a lot of visiting American artists. But Peel comes home and he signs up for the Revolution. He served with Washington in that very tent that's at the American Revolution Center. And he becomes an avid revolutionary. And his painting across from the West and the Copley and so forth is of General John Cadwallader, one of the leaders of the revolutionary forces, and his wife and daughter. Face to face, we have our loyalists and our independents. And that's a kind of story of choice that we wanted to make in the museum. I think the other point that we want to make that I think Matthew can bring up too is that not everybody was free to make a choice. There was a vast population that was disenfranchised at this time. That would have, of course, included 50% of the population, all the women, who really didn't have much of a say in how this went on. And certainly all of the indentured servants and the enslaved persons who had a more difficult time of choosing. And maybe Matthew can talk to a bit about that. We've been trying to highlight stories of African descended people in the colonies at this time. But I think the American Revolution Center does a wonderful job of this.
That's right, Kathy. It's a great segue into a partnership we have at the Philadelphia Museum of Art since our opening in 2017 was that we've borrowed objects from the Philadelphia Museum of Art's collection, including a small collection of Philadelphia furniture, to tell the story of how property was confiscated from suspected loyalists.
There's a family in Philadelphia, the Drinker family, they were a Quaker family here in the city. And during the Revolutionary War, they were trying to stay out of the conflict rather than choosing sides between loyalists and revolutionaries. But they paid the price for that because the revolutionary government was suspicious of them being loyalists and confiscated some of their property following the British occupation of Philadelphia in 1777, 1778. So we tell this story about how the lines are drawn in the revolutionary city here in Philadelphia. And people are struggling through this conflict, even though they're trying to stay out of it. And we tell the story through a display of furniture that approximates the type of furniture that would have been taken from the Drinker family, led by a property confiscation committee led by Charles Wilson Peel. the artist whose artwork is shown at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. We also have some of his art here at the Museum of the American Revolution. And then also to connect with what Kathy was talking about, we do indeed tell the story of enslaved people of African descent who are also faced with difficult decision-making in this revolutionary era. One of the touchscreen interactives that we have at the museum is called Finding Freedom. It also just we also just launched a online version of Finding Freedom on our website this fall. But this interactive allows you to kind of follow in the footsteps of five different individuals of African descent, free and enslaved, in Virginia in 1781, as they faced and made difficult decisions when the British and American armies were battling through Virginia. Some joined the British Army in search of their freedom. Another joined the Continental Army to fight for liberty. And it all goes to the fact that the Revolutionary Era is a time of great change. And a lot of people are having to make just difficult decisions about the future of their lives and the future of the country that they live in.
Continuing the thought of the rest of us, Kathy, the museum has, of course, the leftovers from the upper classes, the rich people. How do we bring in the rest?
We've also been trying to highlight the contributions of people of African descent in the United States and then in the colonies. This is very tricky. It's difficult because the objects don't often survive. And so sometimes what we have done is mine the objects that we have in order to find surprising histories. For example, we have a fabulous collection of ironwork, of stove plates and firebacks. And it turns out that most of the iron forges and furnaces in Pennsylvania were staffed by enslaved people in the 17th and 18th centuries. So that when we look at this ironwork, we can think about the skill that African blacksmiths might have brought to this country. Blacksmithing was a prestigious profession in Africa, and people who had these skills would have been snatched up by American businessmen who ran these forges and furnaces. And so we can see that their skill, their traditions might have been a part of the ironworking tradition in Pennsylvania. The same is true we found in silver. By doing archival research, we found many of these workshops, both furniture and silver, had enslaved workers in them, which draws then to mind the possibility that these objects were made by people of African descent. The only way we can teach that is by drawing attention to this in our labels. So the objects don't look particularly African. They are completely European objects, but they may well have been handled by people of African descent. So we've been trying to bring those stories out in our interpretation of the galleries.
We all are aware of Philadelphia's slave history.
Well, you're absolutely right. William Penn has the enslaved people. So even many of the early Quakers were enslavers. And so this is a deep, deep story that I think has not been told enough. It's absolutely true that the labor force, that is the people stoking the furnaces and the people certainly harvesting sugar and rice and the commodity crops that made many wealthy merchants in Philadelphia able to afford the beautiful things in their homes. We have to recognize the labor that contributed to the economy of the United States in powerful, powerful ways. But we'd also like to tell the story of the finer handwork that also might have been, we might be able to credit now to people of African descent.
You have the portrait of, I believe, isn't it the first portrait that we know of an American Muslim?
It's one of the first. I mean, it's very, very rare. We have a portrait by Charles Wilson Peale of Yarrow Mahmood. Yarrow was brought enslaved as a teenager to Maryland in the middle of the 18th century. And at the age of 60, he won his freedom in the 1790s. And then just by amazing industry and intelligence, was able to buy his own house. He owned bank stock. He was a quite successful person in Georgetown when Charles Wilson Peale met him in about 1819. So this portrait was painted when both the painter and the sitter were in their 80s, two old gentlemen. And you can just see the compassion that is like flowing between Peale and Yarrow. His face is so fabulous. It's just such a remarkable, remarkable painting. But he is wearing a kind of knit cap that is very much like an African Muslim cap. In other words, he's taken conventional American dress, and is using it to sort of signify to other Muslims that he is wearing a cap in a proper religious fashion. So it's a lovely demonstration of a kind of hybrid culture. But Yarrow was literate in Arabic and seems to have been known for walking the streets, singing prayers to God. He was a devout man, and Charles Wilson Peel recognized the kind of universal spirit that he shared with any God-fearing person from any other culture. And so the two of them just bonded, and you can see it in this painting. It's a remarkable painting.
If you're just joining us, this is Philadelphia Focus. I'm Laura Lewis, and today we are talking to Matthew Skick. He is curator of exhibitions for the Museum of the American Revolution, mrevmuseum.org, and Kathleen Foster, the Robert L. McNeil Jr. Senior Curator of American Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, philamuseum.org. Kathy, you talked about your portraiture and, of course, the landscapes. There's one piece of art at the Museum of the American Revolution, and it's a portrait of George Washington. In the background, you see Mercer and Benjamin Rush. It tells a story about the Battle of Princeton. But now, what do we get when we're looking at landscapes and portraits that are not depicting a scene like that? What are we learning about the people? And again, you mentioned that these are the people who are making the decision for everyone else. These are the people that are having their portraits done. But what do we know about the families or these men and the women portraits that you have? What do we learn about that time from them?
That's such a great observation, and it highlights the fact that there's actually very little artwork that deals directly with the war. We have one rare example of a battle scene, which is Paul Revere's famous Boston Massacre, a print. As you probably know, Paul Revere, famous for his ride through Massachusetts, was also a silversmith. And we have the beautiful teapot that he made with engraving on it. It's the same technology he would have used to make the print. It's the teapot that's shown in a very famous painting of Paul Revere by Copley. But that's very rare. Most of the paintings from this period are paintings of just people, portraits, or a few beautiful landscapes, views of people's houses. And I think that kind of imagery shows you the general wish for life to go on normally, you know, for people to just have paintings of their families and of their environment. The war was something that artists kind of shoved to one side. And it makes it difficult to tell the story of conflict because the objects themselves are resisting that story. What we can tell in an art museum about that story of choice is, number one, looking at some of the figures. I mentioned General Cadwallader. He's not wearing his military outfit. He's dressed in very fine embroidered waistcoat and fancy dress. He doesn't look like a military officer. So his role as a general is kind of suppressed in the portrait. But if you poke at some of these portraits, we have also a beautiful portrait of Edward Shippen, who was a judge in Philadelphia, later became a Supreme Court justice. Edward Shippen owned 300 slaves, and that the irony that he would be a revolutionary and would write letters to his friends complaining that the British were treating them like slaves, that he felt that he was being treated like a slave, when he himself was the owner of 300 human beings. That kind of inconsistency, shall we say, among the leadership of the revolution also makes us look harder at the reality, the political reality of the revolutionary moment. The other way that we can sort of think about revolution and choice in an art collection is to think about the dilemma of choice, this idea of loyalty and independence, as an artistic set of choices as well as a political set of choices. Remember, most of the people who were making things, silversmiths and carvers, the great cabinet makers, many of them were born overseas. They were born in Ireland, in Scotland, in France. They came from across the sea, and they remained very loyal to the traditions and the technologies that they had learned from their mother countries. So even if they were second generation or third generation, they would have kept an eye on what was new in Paris or Edinburgh or Dublin or London. And would have felt a wish to become, to be very fashionable, to be very stylish, to be completely with it. So in that respect, they are loyal to the visual traditions that they have come from. But on the other hand, there's a surge of independence here because they want to make something new. I mean, every artist wants to be creative, wants to be inventive. And so you have a number of artists who are also supporting a kind of local American market. They want to do things that suit the American taste. And so you see in this moment the development of hybrids, of new forms, and of new kind of streamlined shapes that are particularly American. You know, so it's a fun moment to watch visually. We have a whole wall of chairs that I think will amuse people. We put the chairs up on the wall so you can see from up underneath them as well as down at them, because there's like a whole set of six. And we wanted people to think about the chairs as a piece of sculpture, as a piece of functional art. I mean, every chair has got a job to do, but look how differently people solve that problem of helping people sit. And then thinking about it as, you know, a piece of sculpture with all kinds of visual elaboration, with turns of technology that are surprising. So that, in that way, we're helping people think about the artist's moment in the revolutionary period and the choices that artists make to be either loyal or independent.
There's a really, the Museum of the American Revolution really does explain concepts very well. We all know about a Stamp Act, but understanding what it really did to the population. And you you do it beautifully with something that kind of reminds me of what Kathleen just said earlier about a simple thing like a teapot and not being able to import these things that our upper class, and Philadelphia was a very cosmopolitan city, the things that the cities wanted desperately, like beautiful cloth, like silverware, these fine products that we had to now start creating here in America to replace. Jump in there.
Right, right. We try to make those concepts you may have learned a little bit about in elementary school and high school, the Stamp Act, the Coercive Acts or the Intolerable Acts, the Boston Tea Party, the Boston Massacre. We try to make those events seem more real. They're true events. They actually happen. People experience them. And how do we allow visitors, you know, 250 years later and people who are interested in learning to connect with these events and make sure that they understand that they truly happened? And one of the ways of doing that is through object displays, which the Philadelphia Museum of Art does so well. The objects are tangible connection to the past. They are evidence of events. They're evidence of decision-making, they're evidence of people's lives. And so one of the displays where we talk about the non-importation boycotts and movement of the 1760s, we pose American-made and European-made objects right next to each other to show how there was a sort of Buy American movement going on, the first Buy American movement going on in places like Philadelphia and Virginia and Boston. So showing American ceramics next to an English-made example, showing a Philadelphia printed linen next to an Indian painted printed cotton that would have been imported by way of London. These are objects that were part of this political movement, and it's objects being politicized to make a point about American rights and liberties in the 1760s. So objects displays are a great way to allow visitors to connect with the past and connect with concepts that might seem hard to grasp just by reading about them. But if you can kind of learn about a person's story or see or come close to an object from that period, it helps bring reality to the past.
Matthew, we have such a beautiful example of that. And Laura, just to your point too about bringing women's stories out, one of our masterpiece paintings is by John Singleton Copley that shows Mr. and Mrs. Mifflin. And it's very beautifully painted. So it's breathtaking in its quality, but it shows Mrs. Mifflin, Sally, working at a tape loom, which is such a remarkable thing to show in a painting. Generally, ladies in paintings are holding flowers or fruit or something, you know, to represent their fecundity and their maternal qualities. She is working on a tape loom, making fringe. It's weird. It's upholstery fringe that you would have put around the rim of the seat of a chair, say, or of a couch. And while we don't have any letters that explain why she is doing this bizarre activity, and very beautifully, it seems to have to do with the Stamp Act. It seems to be a message of domestic manufacturing, saying, don't buy expensive, taxed, imported stuff. Make it at home. You know, use your own hand skills and avoid these terrible taxes. And so it not only is it an illustration of people taking things literally into their own hands, but it's a demonstration of how women could be the drivers of this kind of Buy American, because often the women would have been in charge of this kind of domestic purchasing. They would have been the ones who would have felt the sting of the taxation. And so Mrs. Mifflin, as she stares right out at you, and she is like the star of this painting. She is like an advertisement for American domestic production.
You know, I hate to say it, we are way out of time. Can we wrap this up and tell us, bring us home and tell us how to visit the museum and get the most out of it?
We have been pumping our website with preparatory material for people, so I do hope people will visit. We have some wonderful videos and introductory material, but mostly it's going to be the impact of visiting. I have to say that to me, it's such a thrill to be in the museum and have it full of people. It's so exciting after a year and a half of staying away from museums to see these beautiful new spaces. They are extraordinary. And so those of you who know the museum well are going to just be knocked out. And if you've never been to the museum before, I encourage you to come and explore this amazing treasure and then dive into these new American galleries. I think you will be provoked. I think you will be excited. I think it's a new way to look at American art and American history, and it is a fabulous hand-in-hand experience with the Museum of the American Revolution.
And this summer, we're calling it Revolutionary Summer. We have a lot of great programming, as well as a new special exhibit, Flags and Founding Documents, which traces America's national story from the Revolutionary Era through the 19th century up until the 20th century by way of a collection of about 40 historic American flags that show the changing star counts as new states were added to the Union, from 13 all the way up to 50, and a few aspirational flags that show hopes for inclusion of territories as states. And those flags are paired alongside constitutions from new states as they're added to the Union. And this constitution making is a long-lasting legacy of the American Revolution. One of the very revolutionary aspects of the Revolution was writing constitutions, creating republican forms of government. And so visitors will encounter the early printings of constitutions of Louisiana and Ohio and California. And these are ways that those states are connected to the events that happened here in Philadelphia, for example, including the Constitutional Convention of 1787. And the exhibit includes a rare copy of the first printing of the proposed Constitution from September 17, 1787, printed here in Philadelphia. It's one of 15 known copies of that printing that still survives. So that'll be on loan from the Dorothy Tapper Goldman Foundation. And the flags portion of the exhibit was curated by the leading flag collector and dealer, Jeff Bridgman. So it's a great way to experience American history at the Museum of the American Revolution by seeing flags and founding documents. That'll be open through Labor Day.
And, of course, get more information about the museums. First of all, remember that now through September 6th, you can pick up a very specially priced $35 ticket for adults, good through basically the end of September, that will allow you to see both fabulous museums, the Museum of the American Revolution and the fabulous Philadelphia Museum of Art. And again, for hours and more information, go to mrevmuseum.org and philamuseum.org for open details, hours of special exhibits, and really get yourself informed before you visit so that you can get everything out of your trip to the museum. My guest today, Matthew Skick, he is curator of exhibitions for the Museum of the American Revolution, again, mrevmuseum.org, and Kathleen Foster, the Robert L. McNeil Jr. Senior Curator of American Art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, philamuseum.org. Thank you both for taking the time today to talk to us.
It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, Laura.
And again, remember, for For more information, go to amrevmuseum.org for the Museum of the American Revolution and philamuseum.org for the Philadelphia Museum of Art. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Philadelphia Focus.